This is tape two of the interview with Captain David Howard Emery on the 8th of February.
An interesting story. I was telling you there that I had volunteered worldwide remote, kind of hoping to go to Southeast Asia somewhere.
Right.
Part of that was because of the WAPS test, the Weighted Airman Promotion System test. I had taken the test a couple times for Staff Sergeant and not passed, because 90% of the test was on the F-4, the F-100, the F-105. These were all the warplanes that were fighting in Southeast Asia. There were two questions on the test on T-37. And I just did not see myself getting promoted when I was competing against the guys that were working on these planes day in and day out in Southeast Asia. So I volunteered. Showed up at Karat. I came into the orderly room, and I was standing at this desk ready to in-process with all my papers. The guy didn't even look up. He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I'm here to in-process. What's your name?" I said, "Sergeant Emery." "First name?" "David." He said, "I ain't got time for this." "What are you talking about?" He said, I don't need to be fooled around with here." I said, "What are you talking about? I need to in-process." He said, "You in-processed last week." But no, he didn't. He looked up at me and he said, "You're not the same guy." I said, "You mean there's another David Emery here?" "Yeah, there's another David Emery here." I said, "Well, that's neat. And where does he work?" "He works down at Transient Alert. He's a staff sergeant." I said, "Oh, great, I need to meet him." So after I in-processed, a couple days later, I made my way down to Transient Alert, and I found Sergeant, Staff Sergeant David Emery, different middle initial. And I said, "Hi, I'm Dave Emery." He said, "Oh, I'm Dave Emery too." We chatted for a minute. He said, "You're the guy that works in engine shop, right?" I said, "No, I'm a crew chief." And he said, "Well, I heard there was a David Emery in the engine shop." So I checked into the engine shop. Guess what? There was another David Emery in the engine shop. We'd all process in within a month of each other. Now, I don't know. I really don't know for sure how this works. I volunteer worldwide remote. I have a strange feeling that somebody at NPC, at the personnel center, typed in Sergeant David Emery remote anywhere, compute, and it spit out three sets of orders. I don't know. But we were all at Karat within a month of each other. Two of us were aircraft guys, and one was a shred out, which is just a little different, AFSC, which is engines. And I followed them for a while through the Air Force, and one retired as a Master Sergeant, and one, the last time I heard from him, I talked to him when he was at headquarters Langley, was a chief, I think, senior chief, Master Sergeant. That's when I was a first lieutenant. I don't know, is there anything else specifically you want to hear? I could just tell you.
I'm trying to think of anything that I've missed in back in stories.
Let me tell you a little story about, and this may be significant, something that may be important years from now. I alluded to the fact that guys would run the girls real hard
right
over there. And there was a little mutual running going on there, okay, because the Thai women would take advantage of the Americans, especially younger guys, to get a free ticket, as it were, whether it be money while they were there, or to get married, to get back to the States, because it was a big thing to get to the States for a Thai woman. When I got on the plane in Bangkok, just before I got on the plane in Bangkok, to fly back to the States, remember I told you I was going out commercial on a 747. I was sitting in the airport. Dave Grew was off, doing something else. So I was sitting by myself in civilian clothes, but I had a military haircut. This Thai girl came up to me, and she was had suitcases like she was getting ready to go on a trip. And she said, in very poor English, "Are you American?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Are you going this plane to San Francisco?" I said, "Yes." She handed me a letter. Now, this letter was written by, I think, an Army guy. And it said, "Let me introduce to you my wife," and it gave her name, and child. I had to come back to the States before I could make the arrangements for her to come with me. Everything has been made now, and she'll be traveling. If you would be so kind, if you are with her on a portion of the flight, if you could see that she gets through the entryway into the airplane and through customs and these various things, because she speaks almost no English. I would appreciate it very much, you know, and he signed his name. So she wanted me to help her. And I looked around and I said, yeah, no problem. And I asked her in my very broken Thai, where's the baby? Because the letter said it was, I believe, his son. Mm-hmm. And she said that she didn't have a baby. And I said, this says you have a baby. She said, no baby. And I said, is the baby dead? No. And I said, the baby's not coming. No baby. I said, you have never had a baby? Never baby. Never baby. And I said, your husband thinks you have a baby. Yeah. I want very much to go to America. So she had told this young guy, they had apparently gotten married just before he left, and that jived because he didn't have time to make all the arrangements for her. Apparently told him that she was pregnant, either before they got married or right after they got married or something. Right. I suspect just before they got married. And then he left, fully expecting that he has a son in Thailand.
Right.
Saved up his money, sent the money and all the arrangements, did all the paperwork to get his wife and child back to the States. And I said, this is a problem. She said, yeah, I know. So I said, no problem, I'll help you. And it just so happened that we were the same flight all the way to San Francisco. And the letter at the bottom, you know, it said, it gave the phone number of his parents for somebody to call when they got to the States so the parents or he could come pick them up. So got her onto the airplane. She sat next to me on the airplane. As a matter of fact, she had never flown before. Can you imagine that? She'd never flown before. She asked if she could lay her head on my knee. For 12 hours, her head did not leave my knee except when I said, I have to go to the toilet. She didn't go to the toilet. She didn't sit up. She didn't eat. I would wake her up whenever the food came around and she'd say, no. Woke her up when a movie came on, no. She just laid her head on my knee. It didn't move for 12 hours. I got off the plane in Hawaii. We were standing in line together. The customs people asked me if she was with me. I said, well, I'm just helping her along. I'm married to her. And I showed them the letter and all. And they said, well, we have to take her for a search. Okay. And she came back terrified. They had done a full body search of her for drugs. Mm. And she was just petrified. We got back on the airplane and went to San Francisco. Got in there at night. Called her in-laws. And I said, told them who I was and that your son's wife is here and I'm supposed to call to have someone come. Well, he's working, but we will come pick them up. Are she and the baby okay? And I said, well, you know, you'll need to, you know, talk to her when they get here.
Right.
When you get here. And so I thought, this is going to be interesting. I told him where she'd be. I told her to sit, you know, right outside a little hot dog shop there in the airport. I said, don't move. And I told them where she would be. And sure enough, I stood off a distance away. I told her goodbye. And they came in. They recognized her, I guess, from pictures. And she recognized them, apparently, from pictures. And so they came over, and they embraced her, and they spoke as much as they could for a few minutes. The mother, the father, and apparently the boy's sister was there. And they hugged her. They called her daughter. And never once said, where's the baby? It just shocked me. And they picked up her luggage and out to the car they went. It was bizarre.
Huh.
But that's an indication. I told that whole story, one, because it was kind of strange what happened. But two, that it was not uncommon for the Thai girls, because of the abject poverty that was over there, for them to either be with an American on a relationship basis while the guy was there, as T-Lock, his girlfriend, where the guy would come live in their house, pay the bills, pay the food, and normally it was a package deal. You could give the girl $100 a month, and you could live in her house, she would buy all the food, she would make the bed, she would shine your shoes, she would do your clothes, and everything, and be your concubine for a year for $100 a month. Yeah, and guys, you know, married, single, old, young, you name it, we're doing that. And then they'd leave, and the day they would leave, they'd meet the next airplane or the next bunch of guys that would come into the bar that night, and they'd find a new T-lock, and they'd go at it for another year. Or some of them preferred to go to the States, and they would right. marry the guys. Maybe after they'd T-locked for 3-4 years, had a succession of different boyfriends, then they'd marry one guy and go back to the States. Preferably redheaded guys. They love redheads. Yes, you talk to a Thai woman and ask her what American she liked the best, what kind of American, and they'd say, oh, with the red hair, with the red hair. And you ask them why, and they'd say, because they make beautiful Thai babies. Yeah, it's funny.
Were the troops allowed to stay off the base, or were they supposed
absolutely.
To
Absolutely, absolutely. You could stay off the base, no problem.
I wasn't sure if they were required to.
Some guys were required, younger guys were required to have a room on base. So they would have a dorm room on base, right. and a bed and a locker. And occasionally there would be like a dorm inspection where they'd have to make sure the room was up to date, but they would live, you know, 99% of the time downtown. If we had alerts or things like that, they'd have to stay on base. Let me see some other things just very quickly. You asked about the drugs and the alcohol and the weather and things that might have caused safety problems or whatever. The general attitude that I mentioned to you before about disregard for tech data and right. doing things the right way led to the death of several people while I was over there. Okay. A young fellow was working on one of our airplanes, one of our F-4s in a hangar during one of the phased inspections. He had been on leave for a month in the States to see his new child. He'd just come back. His boss had sent him out to the airplane to remove, to prepare to remove the ejection seat so they could do the full inspection. Mm-hmm. He did not have the right tool with him. He did not have the proper tech data with him. He did not follow the right procedures. He was standing in the seat, leaning over the seat, using the wrong tool, wrong procedures, and tripped the seat mechanism. He had already disconnected the safety device that prevented the seat from being ejected before the canopy had left the aircraft. Mm-hmm. So he had bypassed its safety feature. And when his hand slipped, or this improper tool he was using slipped, it caused the seat to fire through the canopy, which was open on right. the aircraft. And because he was standing on it, the top of the seat, which had a drogue parachute on the top, mm-hmm. caught him under the chin. Now he's riding the seat, and his head broke the 5/8-inch stressed plexiglass canopy. Mm-hmm. As the seat, well, there's a catapult on the seat
right.
that extends about 10 feet, 8 or 10 feet. When it extends, when it's about at the top of its extension, then two rocket motors, well, there's a series of rocket motors, but it's like two big rockets on the bottom of the seat fire to thrust it away from the aircraft. So you right. have this long rod quickly telescoping, and then these rockets light. And they light actually so fast, it's about, as the seat was just passing through the broken canopy, they lit. And they had 50,000 pounds of thrust that hit for about like 0.5 seconds.
Right.
And the seat, he finally was flipped out of the seat. The seat went through the corrugated steel roof and landed outside, to give you an idea of the force. He hit the I-beam along the very ridge of the roof inside and came straight back down. We're talking maybe 40 feet. And came straight back down, spread eagle, on the backbone of the aircraft, with some spike antennas sticking on the top,
right.
impaling him on the chest, and he rolled over onto the wing, right next to a friend of mine that I'd gone through B-66 tech school with. And he was very dead.
Sure.
Very, very dead. Very sad thing, but blatant disregard. The guy had not worked on the system for a month, wrong tools, wrong tech data, no supervision, improper procedures, everything was wrong.
Right.
And that was indicative of how many things happened over there. Just very unsafe.
You had mentioned that alcohol and drugs may have affected it. Do you know of any deaths that they caused, or did it kind of assume maybe it was caused?
None that I heard directly of, no. I'm sure they caused some lapses in judgment. Mm-hmm. Another guy was killed in our row of revetments one night when I was on the day shift, where he was a hydraulic troop inspecting for a hydraulic leak up in the speed brake well underneath the wing of the F-4. Mm-hmm. And he had hydraulic and electric pressure and power on the aircraft. And he extended the speed brakes and failed to put an actuator lock on so that if something happened, the speed brake wouldn't shut. Mm-hmm. And the F-4 is designed with some safety of flight features that I call slam shut features. But what they are is the plane's in the air flying along and you lose electric power, mm-hmm. then some of the hydraulic actuators are spring-loaded to move whatever it is they move to a neutral position so they won't affect the flight. So if you're flying along with your speed brakes out, which break up the flow of air under the wings and slow it down, if you have an electric failure, you don't want the added problem of these speed brakes hanging out.
Right.
So this little spring-loaded switch would cause the actuators under 3,000 pounds of pressure to slam these speed brakes shut so they're flush under the wings.
Right.
He didn't put the safety lock on the actuator. He opened the speed brakes. He turned around, laid his shoulders on the speed brake, mm-hmm. with his head completely in the speed brake well, his flashlight looking for the leak. And he ran out of gas on the external power unit. And the speed brake did exactly what it was supposed to do. With 3,000 pounds of pressure, shut his head in the speed brake well. There's less than 2 inches clearance inside the well when it's shut. Right. There's zero clearance along the trailing edge of the speed brake in the wing. It didn't totally decapitate him, but it instantly killed him. And those are things that just normally don't happen on a stateside base on a day-to-day basis. And those are just two. There were several more that I won't go into details on that happened in the year I was over there. And I attribute that to the wartime mindset of maintenance, which was just not the same as it was stateside.
Efficiency over?
Safety. Safety was disregarded. Tech data was disregarded. Procedures were disregarded. It was kind of like, hey, you know, I know what I'm doing. I'll do it the fastest way I can get it done. I'm a real ace mechanic. Kill people.
Okay. I think that's about it, don't you?
No. Like I say, I could talk for hours, but I think that gives you a pretty good representation of some of the things that happened the year that I was in Thailand.
I appreciate it. Thank you.